rupture is actually part of connection, and so is repair, and it actually creates security and stability.
This is Heart of the Story, and I'm Nadine Kenny Johnstone. I'm an author and a holistic writing coach who talks with today's top women writers about how to navigate life when things don't go according to plan. These impactful conversations and personal reflections invite you to be seen, feel supported, and ultimately fall back in love with yourself. So let's go together to that honest, powerful place, the heart of the story. Hi, my friends. Before we dive into today's fabulous conversation, I wanted to share some exciting news. As you know, I am the proud founder of WriteWell, which is where I offer workshops and retreats for women writers. And I have this online community for the writers where we meet every Monday for a workout. I call it a writer workout. And I lead the writers through an MFA level craft talk and writing prompts, and then we write together. And that group has been going strong for over 5 years. And a few times a year, we open our doors to new members, and we just opened enrollment. You can join, you can register, but you can also try out a class for free on October 6th if you want to see what all the magic is about. So if you want more info, you can head on over to NadineKennyJohnstone.com and or you can click on the link in the show notes. But if you're curious about what happens within my writing community, I want to take you back several years ago. I had been teaching creative writing at universities for almost 15 years. I was writing and publishing myself. I had a memoir out, and all of a sudden, the pandemic happened, and I was feeling so lonely. I was feeling uninspired. I had no bandwidth or energy to do this sort of writing and submitting for publication that I was doing pre-pandemic. And I thought, if I'm lonely, then these other writers must be lonely too. And I reached out to all the women writers that I knew, and I thought, let's just come together. I'll lead you through craft talks. I have an MFA in creative writing, and so I had a million craft talks up my sleeve, and I'll give you some prompts and we could write together. And what I thought might be something that would last for just several weeks became something that's been going strong for over 5 years. And then when the world opened back up, I was able to have in-person meetups and host retreats. And it's just been an absolute joy to watch these strangers become sisters who cheer each other on, who hold each other accountable, who help each other achieve their writing goals. The women in the community have published countless books. They've published hundreds of essays and articles in places like the New York Times, Boston Globe, Huffington Post, Vogue, Architectural Digest, The Sun, Longreads, you name it, they've published there. And it is the joy of my life to be able to cheerlead and cheer on these women. So, if you need accountability, if you want access to monthly masterclasses where I bring in guest teachers, these are expert writing teachers and amazing authors who come in and talk about their area of expertise every month, then you'll want to check out my online women's community. You can join that free class on October 6th. And if you can't make it live, you can watch the replay. All you have to do is register and we'll send it to you. And we hope you will join us to see what all the magic is about. So without further ado, here is my conversation with therapist, embodiment expert, and author, Dr. Hillary McBride.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so delighted you're here.
Likewise.
To start us off, I really like to orient listeners. Maybe you can share with us what this season of life looks like for you, either overall season of life or simply this fall, what this fall looks like for you.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's an ending and a beginning that's happening in my life and in our home in particular, because our daughter, who is 3 years old, has just gone to preschool. And so it's the first time she's ever been out of the house for care and with other people. And so there has been this kind of like, it feels like this cocoon that we had her in, and in a way that I was in with her has been ending, and we are launching her into the world. And I'm realizing all of the places inside of me that pulls up kind of memories about school for myself that shape my projections about what it might be like for her. And so it really feels like there is this little mini launching that's happening of her into the world, even though it's, you know, a half day from school and just around the corner from our home. There is a sense of, wow, that season of her life where she was home and like an infant and a toddler, like it's really, it's ending. And yeah, so there is that, to me feels like a really, a big inflection point right now in my life and in our life as a family. And I've noticed the ways that we have reorganized everything that we have going on to support that for her and to support ourselves as we just make time for the transition. So that feels big, like when I think about locating what's happening right now seasonally.
Yeah, that is really big. Mm-hmm. And when you feel your own excitement and or maybe nervousness about the unknown, what do you do personally to kind of deal with these new feelings of launching her out of your care and into other people's care?
Yeah. Well, I think there is just making room to acknowledge that those feelings exist and talk about them. And I feel really grateful to have a very tight mother culture around me of women who entered into motherhood before I did that I can reference. And sometimes I go to theory too, to remind myself the things that I know about, like, oh, this, like, this is what we do as parents. So it brings to mind a book I read ages ago called Mothers and Daughters Loving and Letting Go. I think it's by Dr. Evelyn Bassoff, but she talks about how this is kind of like the thing that we do as parents is we let our kids go mm-hmm. over and over and over and over again. And to reference that and go, oh yeah, this is not like me and her. This is the thing that parents do. Like, oh, this is actually what we want, is to launch her into the world and feel supported and empowered as she does that and have a place to return to process what happens for her. So theory is helpful for me. Friends are helpful for me. And then I think actually making space to feel my own feelings about it and allow those to exist, to have names, to have space, to let them come up as often as they do, and trying to avoid the I think the popular tool that many of us reach for, the suppression tool of like, it shouldn't feel this way or everyone's over it by now. Just reminded myself, we all get to take our time with how it feels.
Yeah. Our son is 11. And so he's launched into middle school as I'm navigating midlife.
Right, right, right. You're both in the middle of something.
We're both in middle school. Yeah. And, yeah, to realize that it's my job to keep fostering his independence and his launching away from us, that's mm-hmm. actually my job, can be really hard, really beautiful, but really hard. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I realize the countdown, like, oh, he's with us for 7 more years. That's it. And that sometimes that feels too overwhelming. I can't go there. Yeah. But it also does create a healthy urgency of like, this time is really important mm-hmm. to teach him how to be in the world without us, to teach mm-hmm. him how to trust his own body, trust his own knowing, how to navigate situations when we're not there, but something feels good or bad or tricky or, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's where we're at. And I wonder too, I love asking people what's bringing them delight and joy. I'm always interested in hearing that. So these days, what's bringing you delight and joy?
Oh yeah. There's a bakery around the corner from my house that makes this absolutely divine sourdough bread, and they're only open Thursday to Sunday. So today's Thursday and it's going to be gooey in the middle and crusty on the outside, and I'm going to crack it open. There's going to be nobody in the house. I don't have to share any with anybody if I don't want to until later in the day. So there's like the sensuality for me of like bread. I mean, maybe that's not what we think of as being incredibly sensual. I think people maybe think of like chocolate or wine or something. I'm like, I want to wrap my mitts around a big loaf of fresh sourdough bread. So it's like, that feels like delight for me. Like I really look forward to it. I think there's also something about the, like, it's not available every day of the week. You have to wait till the end of the week. It's like, ah, it's coming. So that feels to me like a celebration in a way of like, oh, this is, we've made it for most of the week. That feels like delight. There's also some, I don't know, I feel like some ideas that are spinning in my head that feel kind of delightful and are evoking in me like a spirit of aliveness. And as I'm mulling around like next projects for future books and things like that, it feels really fun to notice the way that my body communicates how alive and excited I feel and how I can use that as a compass direct me towards like, oh, that's the thing I really want to be writing about. That's the thing I want to be spending time researching. And so there is delight in those ideas and also in a kind of meta way, the delight in noticing how delight feels inside of myself and using that to orient myself towards what's next and to know that I can trust that. That also feels like very delightful. What about for you? I'm curious if you want to share something for yourself.
Oh yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, the sourdough situation. So I was raised in Chicago. I don't live in Chicago anymore. I live in Florida, but we just moved 2 years ago. But every summer we go back to the Midwest, and there's a beautiful town called Door County. Well, it's a whole area called Door County, Wisconsin. And it's this little peninsula that sticks out in Lake Michigan. And so it's just like trees and water. And it reminds me just of, I don't know, it's very idyllic, no big box stores. No, it's not commercialized. And all the little shops are family owned or locally owned. And they have these odd hours, which so many people get disgruntled by, but I love because it is resisting the productivity machine. And it's like, we are open these 3 days a week for these 4 hours a day, because that is the healthy rhythm for us and our family and our community. And we're not going to mass produce and XYZ. And so I love, and I have this whole document on my phone of who's open when, so that I
can track.
And there's a sourdough place called Cultured that just opened, gosh, I think a little under 2 years ago. And they have the same like limited days, limited hours. And I am at that door.
Yes, I bet you are. Yeah.
At opening, where not only the sourdough, but the focaccia. And it's just like, But I am at this women's retreat. I'm leading a women's retreat right now. And I am feeling delighted by watching women be reunited with themselves. I'm watching women dance who haven't danced in a long time, and not just like dance at a wedding, but move in their bodies in ways that they didn't know they wanted to.
Yeah.
Oh, watching women. Oh, I love that. I'm watching women collage and do art that they haven't done since being a kid. I'm watching women remember what it's like to like live in community with each other. We're in these cabins together in a ring and like slumber party every night. And so I'm just watching women be reunited with themselves. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that is absolute joy for me. So given that, I've been thinking a lot about the women that I work with and their stories. One of the things that I'm noticing that we are writing about again and again and again is the pain of when we have one idea or hope of what our life will be like, and then something unexpected happens, and then things are different, whether it's a career dream that doesn't come to fruition, or a marriage partnership that is becoming fractured, or we thought our family would look one way and it looks differently, or something's happening in our bodies and there's illness or chronic pain or just change. And so there's the picture we had, and then there's the picture that actually is, the reality that is, and then there's this pain. I wondered if you could talk with us about almost like this double grief, why it's so painful, where we're experiencing this change, and then we're also grieving the loss of like the future we thought we were going to have, or what things were going to look like. Maybe you can talk with us just a bit about why that feels so painful, what's happening within us.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of how I felt when we were looking at a home to live in the city that we are in, as we moved partway through the pandemic. And I remember we would look at these homes and I would start to picture my life in them. Oh, okay, we could put the furniture here. Oh, we could, you know, our daughter could run and play in that area. Oh, this is great. My parents, when they come to stay, they could stay here. And the imaginative quality of projecting ourselves into this place or this reality is no longer like a could be or would be. It, on some level, we're experiencing it. We're connected to it. It belongs to us, right? And I would say on one hand that imaginative projection is actually really important and good, and tells us what we want and who we are and the ways that we hope to be in the world, right? The wanting, right? This is one of the ideas that I'm really interested in right now, is desire or wanting. How essential that is for driving us towards a full expression of ourselves. And so that's important, and we need to be able to do that. And it's important, I'm thinking about this in the context of the neuroscience of imagination too, and kind of the imaginal rehearsal data that we have that suggests when people imagine something, they actually experience it. In a way that our bodies, right? It might be living mostly in a future hypothetical realm, but our bodies are feeling all the feelings that go along with that. We're probably experiencing most qualities of the thing happening, except for our motor neurons actually projecting into, you know, our muscles to move our bodies as if we were moving around the space. Or one of the studies I'm thinking about is pianists who rehearse imaginally and their performance increases. Right? It improves, even though they haven't actually sat in front of the piano to play that piece. It's their mind is doing something. It's actually having an experience. So just to say that the thing that we're dreaming of isn't happening really diminishes the way that our bodies tell the story of that. Our bodies are saying, this thing has happened to you on some level by virtue of you wanting it and seeing it and projecting it. It's interesting how in our culture, we minimize the pain of losing something we want, including a version of our life, as just like, oh, that had never happened. Well, that kind of diminishes the truth of what our bodies say, which is that on some level it did happen, and it told us something about ourselves, and it told us something about how we imagine ourselves to be as an extension of our like aliveness. So I think it can feel like a version of us that really did exist dies.
Yeah.
And I think that we, again, maybe a larger contextual or like framing statement would be, I think we have a grief problem in our culture, in that I think we don't really know how to do grief well. And I don't know if we know how to do endings well in our culture. And I mean, I'm thinking of Ernest Becker's book, The Denial of Death, and just how much of our culture, even terror management theory, he talks about in that book, but this idea that we are constantly actually trying to avoid the things that we want ending. And we're doing so much to try to make that not happen, and not even happen in our, again, imagination and our mind, that it's so hard for us to know how to be with the reality of something dying, including a version of ourselves that we wanted, or a projection into the future, as if it's not a real loss in a way. So we don't have good cultural stories to understand why it feels so real. And we also don't have good cultural stories to explain why the loss then feels so real.
It is so true. We really do. We envision so much. We imagine so much. And it is like we are living that. And it's so interesting to hear the science that our bodies feel like it's happening. And so when we're going through hurt or grief, and we know that we're supposed to be with ourselves, we know that embodiment is being talked about a lot lately, but oftentimes I feel like women then add another layer of shame on, or feel another layer of shame, because they don't know how. They don't know what that means to be with themselves, to sit with the pain, to be in the discomfort, to feel embodied. And I love in practices for embodied living, I love that you have so many tactile things that we can do. But maybe you can walk us through some of the things even that work most for you, or things that you've witnessed are ways that we can be with ourselves in the pain and really sit with them.
Yeah. Well, before I do that, I feel like an urge to respond to your comment about how there's this kind of layer of shame about not knowing how to do that. Because it, to me, feels kind of mystifying how this happens to us primarily as women, where we become disconnected from our body's internal knowing, intuitive sense, right? The felt quality of connection to our aliveness and intuition and strength and passion and desire as it lives in us in a very sensory, tangible way. We don't lose that because we like, oh, misplaced it along the way. Like, that is very intentionally cultured out of us and socialized out of us. And I think it's, Audre Lorde in her book of essays, Sister Outsider, has said, I can't remember which specific essay, that people who are fragmented are actually very easy to control. That it becomes very, very hard to control women, subdue women, objectify women, oppress women who are connected deeply inside of themselves. And so we have systems well-established culture-wide, sometimes even in medicine and religion and, you know, education and whatnot, that move us away from ourselves. And it's so strange to me that at some point we wake up as women and say, oh, I want something different. But then we blame ourselves for being disconnected, when it's like, no, sweetheart, like, that was on purpose. Mm-hmm. And you're not the only one. And it's actually not even your fault that that happened. In fact, you probably were praised for being really good, for being valuable, for being compliant, for being ideal. Like, you actually probably were shown that it was a good thing to be disconnected. So no wonder you're here and you don't know how. Like, that's actually not something you need to feel shame about. This reminds me of a moment in my own eating disorder recovery where I had the sense of my eating disorder not having been this thing that made me bad, but actually this thing that made me good in the eyes of a culture that said, we want you to disappear.
Yep.
So some of the practices that have been helpful for me in reconnecting to my body in general have been, like, not overcomplicating this, not making it into anything more elaborate than I could tolerate in the moment, but simply making space to listen. Listen for sensation, listen for impulse, listen for emotion, right? And then once having listened to that, listen to what happens next. Allowing myself to be surprised by what happens next sometimes. But I think when we think about embodiment, yes, there are ways to take embodiment into this, like, very expansive set of spiritual practices. But embodiment is also, as we call it in the literature, this is a finding from Neva Paran's research. She says it's attuned self-care, right? Like, oh, I'm tired, put myself to sleep. Oh, I'm thirsty, give myself some water. I'm hungry, eat something, right? And it's amazing how hard that is for so many of us who have been taught, no, we have stuff to do, right? I can't go to sleep because I'm tired, or I can't eat because, you know, I already got my, you know, air quote, intake for the day, or I had my, you know, treat or whatever. I'm not allowed to have more food. I can't nourish myself more. So simply starting with things like that can get us into the realm of noticing and tracking sensation. But I think probably one of the biggest things that has been helpful for me and one of the practices that I come to often around pain and sitting and being with pain is tracking emotion, right? Pain usually would be maybe sadness or grief or anguish or something like that. Tracking the emotion as a series of sensations in the body that usually follow a waveform. And if we even have this idea of like an image of a wave, like a bell curve or something, where sensation increases and increases and increases, and then it peaks and it comes down the other side, and there's some very cool things that happen on the other side of that sensation that are worth watching for too. We get an endogenous opiate release. We tend to get insight about what the sensation means. Those are all things that are hardwired into us. But in order to get to that point of getting to the other side of the emotion, we have to do a few things. Usually we have to inhibit some of the stories we're telling about us, ourselves, or the feeling or the circumstance. And it's good to be able to start practicing that even here and now, noticing that emotion or the painfulness of something is usually sensation. And if it has words to it or thought to it, it's usually quite simple, like I'm sad. But when we have been disconnected from that and we live up in our stories and up in our head and our cognition and interpretation and meaning making about things, what we might do is start to spin a story based on that pain about the future and how awful everything is going to be and how nobody likes me and how this is horrible and I can't survive this and it's going to go on forever. And those are actually not core features of emotion. Those are usually things that kind of happen if we're not feeling the emotion. So if we can redirect our attention back to sensation, kind of the core of the ache, the core of what happens inside of our bodies, and inhibit some of the storytelling, then we can actually move through the emotion faster. The other kinds of things that have been helpful in terms of staying with pain are allowing it to become tolerable by using movement or sound or touch or contact or imagery to actually stay with the pain in a, again, felt sense way, as opposed to the story about it. So if I imagine the pain as being like this searing open wound in my chest, maybe what I imagine is cupping the hands of love around that open wound, not to try to mask it or minimize it, but to hold it, right? In the same way that I'm holding my hands the same way that I would hold my daughter's face if she was looking at me in tears, like just holding it, not trying to make it go away, not trying to minimize it. And I think if we can inhibit the stories and we can turn towards the sensation and we can bring in resources, even like sound, like what's the sound this feeling wants to make? What's the movement this feeling wants to make? Or is it easier to be with the agony if I rock myself? Is it easier to be with the agony if someone holds me and rocks me? Right? What are the things that help me actually stay with it? Which is a very different way of looking at pain than how do I make it go away?
Yeah.
Right? Like how do I stay with it changes everything. Because I think that there's a thing that often happens for pain, especially in thinking about heartbreak and grief and anguish, of which I am acquainted. I think that we want to manage and fix them. We want to in some way try to get away from them. And yet we miss how turning towards them actually supports our body to make room for something, supports our body to let go, tells us what's important to us. Like turning towards heartbreak and anguish and pain and doing so in a way that supports us to feel through it. I think it minimizes this loop that we can get in of sometimes feeling like a little bit, but also kind of avoiding. It's like we're trying to look at something through like our, you know, webbed fingers or like our hands in front of our face in a way that we're like, I'll kind of look at it, but I don't really want to look at it because I'm kind of scared about what it looks like and it's going to take over and it's going to be forever. And in a way we touch it, but we kind of prolong it because now we're not only feeling grief, we're feeling the fear of the grief. And now it's like, oh, we got a whole knot of stuff inside. It's like actually, some of these things, when we're not avoiding them, are quite simple. They're painful, but they're quite simple. And it's all of this extra stuff that we do to get away from it that makes it even harder.
Oh, yeah. My therapist and I talk a lot about avoiding.
Yeah.
Because the avoiding of the whatever, the anxiety, the fear, the sensation, the emotion, oftentimes causes more pain than the looking at it, writing it down, speaking it, acknowledging it, holding it. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about that with the women I've been on retreat with and just seeing how beautiful it is when they're crying in front of other people and their initial instinct is to stop.
Yeah.
Or we'll do writing exercises and they hit on a moment where they know they've tapped into something that wants to be written about, but it's really hard. Mm-hmm. And there's just that feeling of like, oh, do I really want to go there?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So I love the image of holding it the way we would hold our daughter's face, a child's face, seeing what you need. Do I need to be rocked? Really being with it. What sounds does it need to make? Any of these things. And it also makes me think about when we're experiencing hurts. Oftentimes it's relational. We're not the only ones with holding this hurt. There might be a crack within a marriage or a partnership or work situation or family. And so there's a little crack, like something has happened. And one of the biggest conversations I have with my friends and other women is like, what do we do when there's a little crack and we don't want that crack to become a chasm? But it's hard to have a conversation and confront it. We want to avoid it. We're just like, okay, well, if we just move on and just let it pass, let it slide, and that never ends well. But we're terrified of confronting the thing or having the hard chat. And I think most of us aren't even taught how to have that chat. It's like, I am desperate for scripts and templates, something that can guide me through when I'm feeling like, I didn't like that. I didn't like how that went. And I want to talk about it, but I don't know how. Do you have any help or guidance for those moments?
Yeah, I do. I do. And again, it's so hard to not like comment in a meta way on why this is so hard. And so many of us, like you said, have not been shown that we can name that something hurt and still be in connection with someone. It feels like if I name that something feels off, the whole relationship is going to be threatened.
Yeah.
Like there's no way for us to stay close if I name that there's hurt.
Yeah.
And yet what we know from the research on attachment and relationships is that rupture is actually part of connection. And so is repair, and it actually creates security and stability, right? We know, I mean, if anyone's been lucky enough to have these experiences, I feel fortunate that I have had many of them with close friends and colleagues and whatnot, is when we can actually name something was off, can we talk about it? Oh, that feels better. That there becomes even more trust that we can do it again and do it again and do it again, which allows us to be braver to notice when something feels off. It actually sometimes soothes if there is a little rupture to be like, oh, I can separate out my projection of this person from what I know to be true, because we've had all of these data points that remind me that, wow, when I do talk about hard stuff, we can go there. Oh, so I actually feel secure. So it doesn't feel as threatening, which means I don't have to be as reactive and I don't have to hide it. And it kind of eases and soothes, like lubricates in a way, like so much of a relational process to have that trust. Like, oh, we can talk about those hard things. So I'll use an example of something that happened recently. I was in a conversation with a colleague and I think I had a reaction right before the call ended. We were on this call talking about this stuff and for work. And I had this reaction, but we had to go. The call was ending and we had stuff we had to get to. And so there was this like, thing that happened in me, but I couldn't explain what happened and I didn't have time. And then I had to rush into like 12 other things. And so it took me a little bit to be able to send an email to this person and go, hey, I felt unsettled the way that ended. I'm wondering how you felt. And like, here's some of the stuff that was happening for me. Can we make time to talk about it? And simply the noticing, and then the person replied and said, I felt unsettled too. And I was like, oh my gosh, oh, good. I'm actually so glad we're on the same page. We both felt that. That actually feels relieving to know that even though it doesn't feel good to feel unsettled, we were both experiencing that in the same way.
Yeah.
And I think that that in particular can be such a soothing thing for many of us who felt like our realities were denied. You know, I don't know how many people listening to this or for you yourself have the experience of knowing something as a kid and asking about it. And everything's fine. Mm-hmm. Right. Or how often we feel something, we're like a partner or friend, like, what's going on? And they're like, everything's fine. And it turns out later, you're like, there was not fine. Right. Like, we just takes a little while for it to come out. Or like, now I understand, you know, mom and dad were getting a divorce and no one was telling me that everyone was fighting behind the scenes. And they were trying to hold it together. So something about like having a shared experience can be really like healing for the younger parts of us who never got to see someone else validate, like, oh, that's what really happened. That really felt that way. So that's like, just as an aside, something to keep in mind if someone comes to you and says, something feels off, being able to go like, oh yeah, that did feel off, is a start of actually building the connection. It's not something that increases the rupture. It's something that actually says like, oh, I'm experiencing reality the same way that you did. And hopefully that gives us courage, a little bit of courage to name that. But I think I like to start, we call these process conversations or making the implicit explicit. That's a term from AADP, which is the kind of therapy that I use. But to make the implicit explicit or having a process conversation, it's a way of saying, hey, something happened there. We don't even have to know what it was. We don't have to interpret it. We don't have to come up with a conclusion. And then you did this and you meant this and you tried to hurt me. Right? It's like, okay, something's feeling off in our connection. And I'm wondering if we can make space for that. I'm noticing when, you know, this conversation happened earlier today. Oh, it's kind of been lingering with me in a way that makes me feel like, oh, kind of uneasy. And I'm wondering if we can make some more space for it. Mm. And it can be as simple as trusting that feeling in our body to say, could we be with that? Like, could we come back? Could we revisit it? Because something doesn't quite feel right. And usually when having these conversations with people, especially if it's new in the relationship, but also like really established in the relationship, I might say things like, I really care about our relationship enough to not want anything to get tucked away and then come back later. Because I actually, one of the things I treasure most about our connection is that it feels really easy to be with you and it feels really close and safe and fun. And I'm noticing when something feels off, like, oh, I kind of want to talk about it because I want us to be able to have the things that are so precious to be about this connection. So I'm bringing this to you, not because like I want to attack you or criticize you. Like that's actually not about this at all. It's like, oh, I think that we could like figure this out. And it would feel good to make sure that nothing felt like murky or unclear here.
Hmm. And I'm thinking too about what happens then, because as we talked about, we weren't taught this mostly. Mm-hmm. Then what happens when we make space? And a couple of things. One, say the other person isn't as like, oh yeah, I felt that too, and isn't on the same energy and is a bit like, what do you mean? You know, mm-hmm. a bit defensive. Mm-hmm. And or when we make space and it's like, it becomes like, yeah, you really hurt me. And, you know, how do we help to respond best, even if the other person has a different tone or energy? Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to assume that most of the people listening to this conversation, when we're thinking about hurt, we're not thinking about like, you know, I like had a plot to murder your spouse or like I've been, you know, stealing money for you for 30 years, that these are just like, I wanted you to come to my birthday party and then you made plans to hang out with someone else. And like, oh, like we missed each other. And like, that was a really, really big important birthday. And I felt like I didn't matter to you. Like that kind of thing, as opposed to like, yeah you snuck into my house and stole my TV in the middle of the night or something.
Yeah.
So I think that it's interesting to remember why, like, why do we bring these conversations to someone? Usually it's because we care about the relationship. Like when we don't care about the relationship, you know, it's somebody on the street who cuts us off and like screams or something. We're not like, I really, you know, you matter so much to me. I want to talk about what happened when we were on the highway. We're like, bye. Like, I don't even, you know, whoa, that was weird. What happened? We kind of let it go, but it's actually with the people who matter to us that the hurt happens. So when someone is defensive, I think it's really important that we don't get defensive, but that we reassure them, like, I actually want to tell you because you matter. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if it would be possible for me to share about the hurt so that you could know about my inner world, so that you could know about what matters to me, because I actually believe that you want to know about what matters to me. And my hope is that if I can tell you, then this can feel connected again. Like, I just want to feel connected to you. I want to bring what hurts me to you so that we can share in the pain of it together. Mm. And hopefully maybe we can do something different next time. Mm. So I think being able to say, like, why am I bringing this to a person, and know that ourselves and then share that, could be reassuring. Sometimes it's also not the right time to have the conversation, and starting the conversation with consent. Mm. Hey, there's something that's been kind of like stirring in me, and I wanted to see if we could make some time to talk about it. Is now a good time or not? Mm. Is now a good time or not? Or like, when do you think that it might feel good for us to just have a little bit of time to talk about something? And allowing a person to say, ooh, not right now. And that not actually mean that they don't care about us or that the conversation is important. But ideally, if they're saying not right now, then that means that when they say yes, that their yes actually means they can be fully present and show up. And I think sometimes, like, I'm a big fan of writing things or emails, because I think we can come back to them at a later day. Like, we can read it, have a reaction, sit on it for 24 hours, come back to it and either rewrite it or reread it. Mm. And sometimes that allows us to feel like, you know, maybe it's a little bit more formal, but also gives us some space from a person's reaction.
Yeah.
So if they're feeling defensive, we don't have to watch that happen right in front of us. So I think, like, just being aware of all the tools that we have available to us around that. And then I think maybe this is like another piece of it. When we are receiving somebody saying there's a crack here, remembering again what I just mentioned, like, why do people bring these things to us? Well, it's because we matter to them. Mm-hmm. So if I can come into this conversation from a position of knowing that I matter to this person, and that they're bringing this to me because they actually trust me and they want to be close to me, okay, that's already going to lower my defensiveness.
Yep.
On some level. But then I think, because these injuries are likely not things that need, again, as I'm, you know, I'm joking about like lawyers involved or like bigger, you know, yeah, scenarios that involve legal matters, I think that it can be really powerful to say to someone, tell me what that was like for you when that happened. Mm. Right? If someone comes to me and said, I was really hurt, like, you, I said we were going to have plans and then you change it. And I, like, I actually then ended up not being able, like, the thing, like, oh, can you, oh, I'm so sorry that I did that and that happened that way. Like, can you tell me about what that was like for you?
Mm.
And just think, like, about what that would be like if, when we brought our hurt to someone, they said, like, tell me more, which is essentially the same relational skill. It's the same skill in relationship as we were talking about as being inside of our bodies. Like, go towards the hurt, go towards it. That actually makes things easier in the long run, even though it's like, oh, I don't want to look at that sometimes. Like, when we say to someone, tell me what happened to you because of that. What was that like? What did that do inside of you? Then I think what it allows us to do is accompany the injury in a way that brings connection to it. Mm. And it restores the sense of closeness. And if we can do that without our sense of defensiveness getting involved, then simply saying, show me where it hurt, show me what it was like, is actually the ultimate repair move. Like, I'm willing to see the pain that I caused in you without defending my own ego. And in doing so, that painful place gets that, you know, face holding, cradling experience. But it's a really hard thing for some of us to do when someone says, you hurt me, to go, tell me more. And I think, you know, I wish, like, this actually feels easier and easier in my life because I've had practice doing this, but I've also, my mom is really good at this. Mm. And I've had experiences, I would say, in the last 10 years or so, you know, much more in my adult life, saying to her, like, that really hurt me, that thing that happened. Remember that time when that thing happened? That really hurt me. And she has said to me, tell me about how else I hurt you. So not even, what was that like? Which is like, she's asked that, you know, tell me what that was like for you. What happened inside of you because of that? But then when it feels like, oh, this is kind of like closed, she said, what else?
Mm.
And what a thing, right? Because it showed me as a daughter that my mom was not so invested in protecting her image of herself as a mother that she was willing to accompany me into my experience, which is in a way the ultimate kind of mothering.
Mm.
And what it showed me is that whatever rupture that I perceived existed didn't exist anymore, right? Because most of the ruptures are like, I won't go there with you, or this is, I'm so in my own stuff that I can't be in your stuff with you.
Yeah.
And to say, take me into where it hurts.
Mm.
Is the exact opposite of that.
And I'm thinking about all the people who desperately want that. Like those words would do so much for them to hear, tell me more, and what else?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there are some people, though, when we bring the hurt to them, they don't know how to say that.
Yeah.
They are invested in their own. And so it's almost like we also have to coach them, but that can feel kind of awkward in the moment.
Yeah.
Like, and now what I'd like to hear is.
I mean, I think that if the person feels like open to being coached, what an empowering thing to say, here are the questions I'd like you to ask. And I'd like you to mean them. Like, here's a list of things, and like, go inside and find the place inside of you that that comes from.
Yeah.
To really want to know this. And great, ask me. Like, I think that it's easy for us to disqualify getting our needs met. Often if we ask for them, like, oh, I want you to do this for me. And then you did, oh, it doesn't matter because I asked you to do it. Like, oh, that shit doesn't count. You should know all on your own. I'm like, I don't think so. I think like, what a beautiful thing that someone in front of us wants to learn how to care for us well, that they would be teachable. Like that to me is a mark of authentic caring, not the kind of spontaneous mind reading that we think it is.
So I could talk to you all day, but last question, your beautiful book, Holy Hurt, is coming out.
Mm.
And I wanted to just ask about when we have been through trauma, betrayal, when we feel a sense of mistrust, there's often a lot of rebuilding of trust in our own bodies that we have to do, getting in tune and in touch with trusting our own intuition, thinking just a lot about trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering for anyone who's experienced a sense of betrayal and trust, how to develop trust again, maybe within themselves. And maybe looking at the world more trusting again, even if they initially feel very untrusting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just unpack that for us, Hillary.
Sure. I like to think about trust as being something that we could build in like little small ways too, that feel like perhaps don't seem to be connected to the large scale, like I trust who I am in the world and I trust reality, but are more like these little rehearsals that when they're in an embodied way, when they happen in an embodied way, we carry them with us everywhere we go. So back to what we talked about, like, am I hungry? Can I feed myself? Can I actually notice that sensation and say to myself, I believe you that you're hungry. I believe you that you're tired, even if we can't give ourselves the thing that we need. To kind of honor the reality, because I think so often in these spiritual religious contexts where there has been a fracture of relating to self, there's a system-wide effort to disconnect a person from what they know in a way that actually makes what they know bad, makes what they know dangerous. So experimenting, I think, can also be really helpful, or having relationship, having a person say, I saw you know that thing. I saw that in you. And I believe you too. I saw the way that when you kind of reacted to that situation, you felt scared. That scared makes sense to me because I think that situation is scary. So to have people see what's happening inside of us and affirm it and validate, reify it, like to make it real. To reify it with language and consensus validation is important. And then I think little experiments like, okay, can I trust myself? Like, okay, even just a thought experiment for people, like when I connect with what I want, what is it that I want? Well, it's not to go like murder and steal. Like, oh, what do I want? Like, I want this, like this thing I didn't have. I want this like relational experience. I want this dream. Like, is that so bad? Is that actually like, is that a contamination in some way of my social context or my family or my religious group? Like, no, actually, those are not bad things. But when we can kind of experiment with what is inside of ourselves, just to touch it, what really is in there, that I think we can start to not only trust the sensation, but we can trust that our, like our instincts are good. Our heart is good. But so many of us have been so cut off from our heart that we've never even looked inside to see what's in there. And so to just be able to look inside and go like, oh, there are dangerous, awful, bad things in there.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I can trust what I know, but I can trust actually my essence. I can trust that the core of who I am, that I'm good.
That feels so good. I do it with my son when I see him paying attention to his own body. I try to note it out loud to him.
I love that.
I saw that you just checked in just now and you responded to it. I saw that, you know, you felt a certain way about that and you gave yourself what you needed. It's like I'm trying to reiterate to him how much he's paying attention. And one of the things I do in my journaling every day is I note a moment of self-validation. So I say something like, today I was feeling like I really needed alone time and I gave it to myself. It's a way of reminding myself that I'm honoring myself. And the more that I do it and the more that I note it, the more I do it. I loved this. I feel like people will have so much guidance for how to have hard conversations, how to repair, and how to connect back in with themselves and with other people. And maybe also if they're having a hard time with another person, they could just send it to the person and say, hey, listen to this. And now that other person will have a script. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for coming on today. It really meant so much to me, but I know that everyone out there who's listening has gotten so much goodness from it.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
This conversation was so powerful, and I hope that it did a great deal for you. Don't forget, my friends, that on October 6th, you can join my women's writing community to see what all the magic is about. The link is in the show notes. And special thanks to my dear producer, Michelle Rado, for making this podcast everything that it can be. And remember, everyone, every heart has a story and every story has a heart. See you next time.